So last Monday, I made mention in the talk to the idea of people making progress in meditation. And then promptly at 9 o'clock, when we're supposed to all go home, someone asked what I meant by progress. So I said I would talk about it this week, today, because it's a big topic. And I find myself today, I was thinking about what I was going to say about this topic. I found myself having some trepidation about picking up the theme and the topic. And the more I thought about it, the more either easier it became or more complex it became, the whole issue of progress, meditation progress, spiritual progress. And if I made it too easy, then people are going to feel, some people are going to feel left out. And if I make it too difficult, people are going to feel left out. So I'm not sure where to begin or what to say about progress today. Maybe I should have just answered it last week. The danger of talking about spiritual progress is that I think the very idea of spiritual progress lends itself to people thinking that there's something, some spiritual system or spiritual reality, spiritual truths, or some spiritual people who kind of know something you don't know, or who it's something external to yourself that you're going to measure yourself by, something you're supposed to grow into, attain, relax, realize, become, something. And I'm actually more comfortable, for the most part, with starting in the opposite direction, not starting with something external to yourself to measure where you make progress by, but rather to start with who you are now, today, or in this particular situation. And what is it that is your deepest intention? What is your deepest heartfelt wish? What is it that you want your life, or your spiritual life, your meditation life, your mindfulness practice to be about? And then I'd prefer to kind of meet you there and look at so-called progress, if that's interesting for you, according to whatever internal criteria you have about what your hopes and aspirations might be. And some of that exploration might be to clarify what your aspirations actually are. And sometimes a lot of spiritual practice is about actually clarifying that intention that we have, because some of the intentions we have are not so wise, or they're only 80% wise or something, and we're kind of clarifying and purifying our intention, what we can do. And I know that one of the many reasons go on retreat is that our spiritual intention gets tested in the fire of a retreat. We are trying to follow through on your spiritual intention moment by moment all throughout the whole day. It's very different than doing it, you know, maybe, you know, 30 minutes each day, or an hour each day, if you meditate every day, or if you're a weekend Buddhist, you know, maybe you meditate just, you know, Saturday morning. And just do a little bit, you know, you just kind of, it's very different. And one of the ways it's different is that you could have a very lofty, or have an intention for yourself and your practice, and in doing, and only following through, trying to live up to that intention for a very short time will not reveal to you the fault lines in that, the way you're engaged in that intention. So, for example, when I was a new meditator, I had all kinds of intentions about getting concentrated or becoming calm, you know, getting more spiritual or something. And when I would sit and meditate every day, at home by myself, mostly I was unwinding. And I would pat myself on the back and say, oh, good, you know, you're such a good spiritual person. You're kind of making good progress here. And there was a certain amount of conceit involved in what I was doing. But then when I went on retreat, I discovered that the ego, the self-centered kind of attitudes involved with holding that intention, the way I was using it as a way of building up my sense of self, couldn't be sustained in the fire of trying to maintain the practice moment by moment in the retreat. And it became very obvious to me the fault lines of the intention that I had. Does this make sense to you, what I'm saying? So a lot of what spiritual practice, I think, is about is clarifying our intention, purifying it, making it, figuring out what it, first of all, figuring out what it might be. And then as we work with it and are mindful with it, it gets refined over time until we get something very refined, very pure. And having a very pure, very personal intention that arises out of some deep purity of our heart that is our own, I think is much more valuable than having some, to read all the books on Buddhism or hear me give a talk about what progress is in Buddhism. And then you can all go home and huff and puff and try to attain that. Or say, well, forget that. I mean, whatever. So what is your intention for your practice? And what would progress look like for you? That's kind of, I find that a much more interesting question. And I suspect we have a room full of maybe 80 people here today. And I suspect we have 80 different answers to that question. And is that more valuable than hearing what a Buddhist idea of progress might be? To explore that interface of what your intention is for your life and what it would mean for you to follow through on that, to live up to that, to align yourself by it. And I say this, as I was thinking about, this topic today and thinking a little bit about saying what I just said, it was very much inspired by a feeling of great respect and almost reverence for everyone. That, my feeling is that it's really, it's awesome in all the connotations of the word to be a human being. It's not difficult to be a human being. It's not difficult to negotiate and find our way in human life and with all the demands and external demands and internal demands and needs. And, it's often not that easy. And I think people who come to a spiritual life and are follow through on a regular basis are doing it usually because something is not working so well. And they realize there must be a better way. There must be another way. So I can find some other way to live that will make things go better or smoother or have deeper meaning for me or deeper sense of purpose or something. And I feel just a lot of respect for, what people are up against in human life and society and work and family. I feel very shy to give kind of a, today at least, to give kind of a Buddhist talk. That then you would measure yourself against that. Perhaps what a Buddhist talking about Buddhist notions of the path and progress, my hope, and if I did talk about that today, is that you saw it as an encouragement for your practice, somehow help as a mirror for yourself to see, how to be inspired and be encouraged to follow through on what your intention is. Because there is no spiritual life without living it. And it's obvious, right? And if you decide, that's really a great idea to have a spiritual life, to meditate, to be mindful, and it's a great sense of purpose, and you really love the idea of doing it, and you get around to it, on the first day of the month, for 30 minutes, and then you kind of put it off for the next month. I mean, that's fine. I mean, I'm not going to criticize that at all. But you're not living that life. That spiritual life is not being lived then. So there's no spiritual life except by living. It's somehow following through on something which is our own intention. And so part of what progress means in the spiritual life is that you begin feeling that you can follow through on what your intention might be. And being able to follow through with it day by day, hour by hour, minute by minute. And it's, you know, one of the beautiful reasons to go on retreat is it's a place to try to follow through in a kind of consistent way throughout a day that it's very hard to do in normal life where there's so many distractions and activities that keep us, you know, going. But retreat is also one of those places where you can get a sense, a feeling of what it's like to follow through minute by minute, moment by moment, and get a sense of how maybe it can be done in daily life then as a possibility. And then one of the ideas of progress then is that actually you're able to put together more moments throughout the day and the week and the year of following through on your intention for yourself, your wish for yourself, whether it's to be more mindful or to be more compassionate, more present, more free, more loving, more connected to something that seems very profound and important for you. Sacred realm of life, which is maybe always present. So that's one idea of progress, is that you're following through on what your intention is, what's important for you. And so one of the things that I would want to explore with people when I talk to people about their practice is how well are you following through on what your intention is? Are there ways that we can support that and help that and move it along? So it's something you do much more often. Do you want to do it more often? Or are you happy just to have it be something you do, you know, in the morning for a period of meditation? And then whatever benefits that come from that kind of carry over as if by osmosis into your rest of your life. And you don't give it much thought anymore. So to make progress, minimum means you're following through. Your effort, your endeavoring is there. There is no spiritual life except by living it. In the same way that, you know, in a sense, you go, you know, if you go to a restaurant, we don't eat the menu. You know, sooner or later you have to order the food, or you look at a recipe, you have to cook the food to make something to eat. How many spiritual books can you read? There's a phenomena in America. I think this name arose out of the publishing industry, because there's a whole industry now publishing Buddhist books, right? And there's a term called the bedside Buddhists. These are people who don't feel no particular affiliation to being a Buddhist, don't call themselves a Buddhist or anything, but they buy books and they have it. You know, this is what they read on their before they go to sleep at night. The bedside Buddhists. You know. And of course, publishers are very interested in bedside Buddhists because they buy the books. So, in India, maybe especially in ancient India, Buddhism was not known as a religion, because religion is a Western word. And one of the interesting things you learn in religious studies is how the difficulty that Asian languages had in translating the Western word religion, because they didn't have any good, you know, match for it. And so they kind of invented words. The Japanese invented a word for it. And so we have all these assumptions of what a religion is when we use the word. But here we have a whole culture that doesn't have the word in their culture originally. They had to invent, you know, kind of. So Buddhism wasn't called a religion. It was one of the reference points for it, markers, was it was called a path, a marga. It was a path that you follow. Religion, for many people in the West, implies an ism and a tenet, a belief. A marga implies more something that you follow, a place that you walk, something you follow through on, a place you go. So Buddhism was known as a path that you follow. And then there were a lot of different understandings of what the path might entail. But a path usually entails going from one place to another, and which involves some change. And I think spiritual practice in some way or other involves changing. And you can look at progress as how you're negotiating that change. It can be very simple. It can be, you know, are you becoming person who's less in conflict with the world, with yourself? Are you becoming more loving? Have you become more accepting? Are you no longer getting in the way of reality flowing through you? Are you becoming more concentrated? Are you becoming freer? Are you becoming wiser? There are all these ways that you can look at someone making a change, a transition, as they go along a path. The idea of a path also implies that it really is, as I've said before, it's a kind of endeavoring, something you have to do. You have to enter into it. I love the idea of a path. Traditionally in Buddhism, a path in the ancient world was some place that you walked. And when you go for refuge in Buddhism, the word for refuge, which is kind of what makes a person a Buddhist in a sense, is the Pali word for it, it literally means to walk. Buddham saranam gacchami. Gacchami means to walk. And we usually translate to go for refuge. So inappropriately, we sometimes translate it as take refuge, which seems a little bit odd to take it. But to go, to walk, means you walk something you do with your whole body. You enter all of yourself into it. The idea of entering all of what you have into the path. A path is something you bring all of yourself into. So another idea of progress, a little bit related to the way I talked earlier, is are you bringing everything, all of who you are into it? Or are you holding some of who you are back? And the answer is, of course you're holding something back. I think for most people, or everyone, that's why we have a spiritual path, is because we're dealing with the fact that we're holding something back. We're holding on to something. And it's very common when people practice, and they're really following through on their heart's deepest intention and wish, it's very common for people sooner or later to become afraid. At least in Buddhist circles that I've been in, Buddhist people, many people I've talked to, fear is a very common phenomenon that arises. Because it becomes very obvious at some point that there's a necessity to let go of something we've held on to for our security, for our sense of well-being, for the way we orient ourselves to our life. In particular, some notion of self, holding on to some notion of self. And sometimes it can be terrifying. I've seen people have panic attacks on retreats. Nothing's happening, except they're up against this wall of attachment to self. And they don't have a clue how to live in the world without holding on to some idea of this is who I am as an orientation. And the idea of letting go of that, which they realize, they come to a place where they realize that this is what's asked of them, what's asked next is to let go of that. But to let go of it is, it's so unknown, so terrifying to step beyond that. So it's a whole process, I feel, of more and more kind of stepping onto the path and discovering in the process of doing that what we're holding back, how we're being reluctant or hesitant to put that part of ourselves into it. Not that. Not that. I'm being asked to look at that now. I'm being asked to include that or let go of that. No. All that other stuff was good. I mean, I'm happy to look at my suffering and let go of my suffering. But then, you fill in the blank, something. But to enter, to bring everything involved. So part of progress could be looking at how you're holding yourself back from really plunging into or following through fully in what your heart's deepest intention and wish is. My first kind of one of my first inspirations to look at Buddhism, it was pretty much kind of intellectual in my interest initially, but still the movement was that I was a freshman in college during the Vietnam War time, and I was the most extreme pacifist on the dorm floor. And we had lots of arguments about war and violence and nonviolence, and I was always taking the most pacifist stand because that was my position. And I realized in having to deal with all this, that If I was going to follow through on my pacifist ideals, I would have to, at least in theory, be willing to put my life on the line, to put my life, put myself in a situation where, because pacifism for me didn't mean you just kind of, you know, sat quietly in your room and did nothing. It meant that you'd be willing to kind of do nonviolent civil disobedience, which meant, you know, danger. And so I realized that I was afraid to die. And my fear, that fear I recognized, could get in the way of me following through on my pacifist ideals. And so one of my first interests in Buddhism then was, I felt like I had to deal with this fear. And I didn't know, how do I deal with it? I didn't know. So I was kind of looking around, and somehow I got this idea that Buddhism was a spiritual practice that dealt with this kind of core kind of fear and helped you resolve it and deal with it. So Buddhism is a path, or suggests a path. Life is a path, so it's not saying much that Buddhism is a path. And then within the history of Buddhism, or within, there are different understandings of what the path is. And what I'd like to suggest today is three different models of the path in Buddhism. And I'd like to go through them, each of them separately. But as I do so, you might want to keep in mind that I actually consider that all three work together. And that even though historically in Buddhism sometimes they're kept separate, and there's been a tension between them in over the centuries in Buddhism, I think whenever you have a tension that lasts for more than 1,000 years in a religious system, probably the elements of tension are all required, needed elements to each other. You're not going to do away with them. You better find some way to hold them all together rather than choosing one or the other. So the first path is called the path of cultivation. And the word is bhavana marga, the path of cultivation. And it's a path of developing ourselves. It's kind of, you know, ancient version of a self-development program. And the idea is to take some part of yourself and develop it so it becomes stronger, more enhanced. So, for example, developing our concentration. The concentration is a muscle that can become stronger and stronger the more you work on it. Mindfulness, developing the mindfulness, like a muscle, it gets stronger and stronger. Developing our loving kindness. Developing our compassion, developing our patience, developing our capacity to be very accepting of life as it is, or ourselves. To develop the capacities that we have in some way. And I think it's really one of the most beautiful things that one of the beautiful things human beings have is the capacity, is these potentials inside of ourselves that we can develop and strengthen and make them shine. And different people will focus on different potentials they have. Different people have different strengths that they have. And it was just a few Mondays ago where I talked about the Buddha, talking about different people who had different, you know, excelled in certain aspects of perhaps spiritual life. And I gave that talk to the idea that each of us is different from each other, and each of us has a potential perhaps that we could follow through on. And what is that? And what is, you know, and what is it to find really our own, and not to assume that, you know, not to adopt anybody else's idea of who you should be. And myself, I'm the kind of person who very much loves to be engaged, just to do. So the idea of developing a potential is just a lovely idea to me. The idea of just the idea of being involved in that is fun. Whether I'm successful or not, that's kind of almost secondary to the idea of just kind of, okay, let's do this. So sometimes the idea of getting concentrated, it can be lovely. I just love the idea of kind of being in there and trying to develop my concentration and develop a self-understanding, understanding my mind well enough so that to really let the concentrated state arise as easily as possible. This is a lovely thing to do. And some there are times I've been a complete failure at it. You know, sometimes it's very hard to get concentrated, and I've suffered a lot. Also about trying to get concentrated. But it's a lovely thing to do. And it's not necessarily a Buddhist thing to cultivate and develop these kinds of potentials. athletes, musicians, all kinds of people in society in different professions and vocations will develop certain kinds of skills that they have. And those skills get better and stronger the more we do them and act on them. So traditionally, Buddhism was known as a path of cultivation. You're cultivating yourself. And so that you have this very strong inner strength that supports the possibility of doing the letting go work that's also a very important part of the practice. There's a Japanese form of psychotherapy called Marita therapy that was very much inspired by Buddhism. It arose out of Japanese Buddhist kind of things. And it's a fairly different understanding of therapy than often here in the West. And there the understanding of therapy in this particular school is you don't try to deal with your complexes and neuroses directly. What you try to do is to develop your capacity to act in the world, follow through on how you want to live in your life in such a way that those your neuroses don't get in the way, your fears don't get in the way. So it's called constructive living in English, where you try to develop the strength, the inner strength, the inner resolve, the inner whatever, so that you can act in a way, so your activity, the focus is so much on activity, how you act, you're not being inhibited in how you act. You can do whatever you feel like you need to do in your life, say what you need to do or do the actions you need to do. And you don't need to go look at where your deep, darkest problems are. If you act in a way that's successful in life, that's enough. So I don't know if this works so well in America, where we're so kind of inwardly focused on our faults. But I do know that as we develop this potential within us, the strengths within us, it changes the inner ecology of how we look at our faults, our problems, our fears. And they tend to look less and less threatening or less and less inhibiting or less and less problematic when we have this great big shiny strength that coexists with it. A mind which has, for example, is very deeply concentrated, that has great kind of strength of concentration, will feel in a sense like you're bigger, you're grown up than the particular problems that you have. It's not to belittle the problems that we have, but it's to it changes. You know, it's like say that you have say you have a little weakness in your lower back. And you could maybe work on that particular weakness itself and make it go away or do something. Or you can strengthen your whole torso, your muscles, your abdomen, and your thigh muscles, and all kinds of places. And as they get stronger and stronger and stronger, the fact that you have a weakness in your lower back becomes insignificant compared to all the strength you have. Am I making sense? Is this interesting you still? I got something. I was worried I was boring you. I'm not boring you too much, am I? Going on and on here. You know, it's a risky thing, you know, to be a Dharma teacher and have these monologues. You know, in usual kind of society, you don't go on and on and talk. You know, without giving the people a chance to talk back. So I'm still getting used to this sometimes.
Nobody's leaving, right?
No one's left. So the path of cultivation. There's someone going. You see, it's the person who asked the question.
Maybe just about.
The second kind of path can be called the path of letting go. And you find some people emphasize that the Buddhist path is all about letting go. Letting go, letting go, letting go. And sometimes a meditation hall is called, in this school, is called the garbage dump. because you know you think of it as a great spiritual place, but it's really the place you come to dump all the stuff you got, all the attachments and everything, and you leave it here, hopefully. And then in the middle of the night, we have these gnomes that come by and they kind of shovel it out so we can come fresh next time we come to sit. And then you just let go. And the more thoroughly you can let go, the better you are letting go, the more progress you make and the happier you become. You let go of, you know, all your attachments, all your fears, all your sense of self, everything. More and more. More and more self-effaced, is that the word? The word effacement is on my mind these days. My wife has started to become effaced. I didn't know until a few weeks ago what this was. So letting go. And it's a powerful thing to let go, and it's a beautiful practice just to practice let go. And it's one of the things to do in particular contexts. You might experiment with just practicing letting go. Maybe on retreat, it's a safe place. Just let go of everything that you're holding on to. Any idea you have. Let go of any idea of how things should be. Or choose some hour of your day, 1 hour of your week. Okay, in this hour, and make sure it's a safe place. Don't do it on the freeway. within reason, right? And just practice that you're going to let go as an experiment of any idea of how things should be. How you should be, how anybody else should be, how anything should be. Just let go and let go. Just let go of whatever you can. It's very powerful. There's one friend of mine who struggled a lot in his practice because he had this idea of he was following the path of cultivation. And the path of cultivation can be a demon for some people because they're trying so hard and they're trying to live up to something and trying to succeed. One friend of mine, different friend of mine, when we were in Burma together, the Burmese teacher we had got really angry with her because she wasn't making enough progress in meditation. And he told her at some point, don't come back again for an interview until you can show me progress. And, you know, that's a recipe of getting more tied up in knots and making less progress. And it actually was a disaster, what happened with her in the end. But this different friend of mine was, you know, also following the path of cultivation, thinking he had to do something, and he was always trying to do something. And then he heard that, well, maybe he just had to let go. You know, there's another one more doing. You know, he was practicing letting go. And he just tied himself in knots with trying to let go. You know. And so finally he was told, every time you notice you're going to try to practice something, just stop. Let go of that. Just let go of any idea, even the idea of you're going to let go. And the idea was, he had to keep showing up at the retreat he was at. He had to, you know, go to every sittings and do the schedule. He had to be there and sit, be in the posture. But once he was there, he wasn't allowed to practice. He was given very strict orders. You're not allowed to do any kind of Buddhist practice at all, any kind of practice at all. If you notice any intention, any movement to practice, any at all, you stop. And that was so powerful for him because it threatened and challenged some of his deepest seated beliefs about who he was and what he had to do to get, you know, to fix himself or to be successful or to be something. So letting go is a very powerful practice. Letting go, letting go, letting go. The third kind of model of the Buddhist path can be called the path of no path. And that is that there's no path to be followed at all. And it's a little bit odd, the idea of no path, because at the minimum, there's a path of getting to the no path. Before, I didn't realize there was no path, but now I realize it. So you've made that transition at least. But the path of no path is very powerful, and it carries a tremendous amount of authority in some schools of Buddhism. It's held up as being the highest. In China, the Chan path is considered to be the cream, the top, the high, top of the hierarchy of Buddhist practices. You're supposed to do all the other practices first. They provide the foundation for doing the Chan practice. But the Chan practice is a path of no path in the end. So you follow this path until you're ready for that. Part of the reason it has a fair amount of authority is that it seems to be the perspective of life and how to live a life that people have once they get enlightened, once they're enlightened. It makes some sense. Once you're fully enlightened, there's no path to follow anymore. There's no path. You're living life with no path. But then the teaching has been that you can actually, you can try to live that way. You can try to practice that way. You can somehow realize that, or ease your way into it, pretend. The tantric way is to pretend, is to assume this is the case, and then try to live into it as if it's the case. As if you're already a Buddha, be a Buddha. And in being a Buddha, in acting like you're a Buddha, you become a Buddha. One variation of this no-path path. The no-path path is very powerful when we realize the tremendous role that conventions have in our life and how it's possible, to, at least to intuit, a sense of being alive outside of negotiating life through conventions. So the example that I give, I usually hold up flowers. I mean, some of you have heard this before. But I don't have any flowers here. But I'll hold up some objects. So if I hold up this nice envelope here, you know, you're supposed to hold up a flower.
It's a flower.
I'm not going to pretend it's a flower, but usually you hold up a flower. It's much more beautiful. Or, you know, it's very suggestive, a flower suggestive of the heart opening or the path opening. But sometimes a flower is just a flower. And that's what it is. Anyway, so I'm holding up this envelope. And so you're wondering, what's the big deal? You know, just an envelope, right? But the big deal is that right now it's just the envelope in and of itself. But something different happens when I hold up this object next to it. And now a whole new thing has happened. Now this has become the small object, and this is the large object. This wasn't a small object before. Now it is. So something new has been created by comparing it with another object. And then I'm capable of tremendous magic. And it doesn't even require a sleight of hand. You can watch the trick. And what I put this down, and then I hold this up and put this next to the envelope. And now this is the big object. What was small is now big. Big and small does not exist in the object itself. It exists in the comparison our mind makes in comparison to other things. It belongs to the conventional world of comparisons. And why this is significant is that our minds, most of its time, is living in that world of conventions, of comparative thinking. Most of the problematic senses of self that we have that causes suffering and problems for us is a form of comparative thinking. We are comparing or measuring the self with other selves, with ourselves in the past, ourselves in the future, with wishful thinking, with ideals. There's a world of difference between seeing the envelope as itself. In Buddhism, it's called the suchness of the envelope, compared to seeing it as a small object. When we see it as a small object, we're no longer seeing it in and of itself as it is itself. So the path of no path is a path of learning how to step outside of our conventions and learning how to see things directly in their suchness, sometimes called the thusness. Suchness of things in and of themselves. And in the suchness of the in and of themselves, there's a sense of completeness or fulfillment, or all the ways in which we make problems out of stuff tends not to exist there so much when we just see it in and of itself as it is. So, you know, I mean, right now, just focus, what I encourage you to focus on is just yourself. Do you have some way of accessing yourself in your suchness, independent of future and past, independent of all the shoulds, who you should be, all independent of all ideas of what you aren't, what you don't live up to. Just as you are. So the path of no path is to rest, or to find that place of suchness and to rest there. The path of cultivation, in that involves measurable progress, involves that conventional world of comparisons. You can use that for your advantage, or you can use it for your disadvantage. And you have to be very careful if you're using and following the path of cultivation that you use it in the right way. But as we develop our inner strength, our inner clarity, our capacity to be insight and seeing deeply, that itself will help us to let go more thoroughly. Be easier to let go. And the more we can let go, the more we'll realize the suchness of the moment. The magic, the wonderful awesomeness of the present moment. When we have no before and after and no measurement, just seeing it, the thusness of it itself. So three notions of the path. Progress maybe looks a little bit different in each of them. And I hope that whatever path you're following, whatever your intention is in your life, for your spiritual life or your meditative life, that you're able to follow through on it deeply and well, or at least as deeply and as thoroughly as your heart's as is your heart's deepest wish. I hope you have some way of listening to your heart's deepest wish and then getting out of the way, clearing the obstacles from the path so you can really follow that path through your forest. And I hope that it makes you more loving. I hope it makes you much more appreciative of the people around you. And I hope it makes you much more conflict-free, without any conflicts with yourself and the world around you, so that you can become happier, freer, and more helpful to your neighbors. So that talk was what it was. And please live in the suchness of this talk, so I don't have to go home wondering whether it was a bad talk or a good talk. It is what it is. And I wish you all well. And I'm sorry to have talked the whole time. So that because it would have been nice to have heard from you a little bit, your comments about this kind of topic. But probably we should end. And may you all be well.